It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we're turning from chimpanzees to bonobos now. The Great Ape Trust made a lot of news when it came to Des Moines. It was home to superstar bonobo Kanzi and six other bonobos, and an ape language program that's been going on for more than 30 years. The Great Ape Trust continued to make news and stir up controversy. It's also been through a few name changes, and now it's under new leadership with another new name. It's now called the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. It's home to five bonobos, including Kanzi, of course. And Bill Hopkins is the president and staff scientist there now. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Charity. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here today.
No trouble.
And Bill, tell me a little bit about your background, because you actually had encountered this research project and these bonobos before, when the project was based in Atlanta, right?
That is correct. I've had a longstanding connection with both, individual connection with a number of the bonobos that we have in Iowa now, dating all the way back to the early 1980s. I moved to Atlanta from Wisconsin and was in graduate school at the Language Research Center, which is part of Georgia State University. At that time, Kanzi and some of the other bonobos were living there, as well as some chimpanzees that have been part of the Language Research Center and the language work. So I was working in that lab and doing my PhD work there at the time. And in fact, Kanzi was two when I started working with them.
All right. And for people who aren't familiar with the history of this project, when Kanzi was two, that was really the age at which this project turned or took off, because at that point, the researcher Sue Savage Rumba was trying to teach his adoptive mother Matata language or lexigrams, symbols to communicate with, and Kanzi spontaneously started picking them up, and he became the focus of the project.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, you know, we were working one-on-one oftentimes with Matata. Kanzi was with her, and, you know, once, you know, he began to show some promise, you know, we began to focus a bit on him, and, you know, I just remember talking with Sue one day and saying, you know, I definitely have the impression he understands, you know, the speech that our speech signals, not necessarily just the symbols. And, you know, she was like, wow, that could be really remarkable. And it turned out that his speech comprehension abilities were very advanced even at that age, and, you know, of course, became even more sophisticated as he got older.
Right. And as this project continued, I mean, Kanzi was really the superstar standout bonobo as far as picking up these lexigrams, understanding human speech. His sister, Pambanisha, also had a remarkable vocabulary. But there are also bonobos, and Pambanisha has passed away. There were bonobos also in this group that did not acquire language. So can you describe for me a little bit of the dynamic of the five different bonobos that now are part of the project?
Well, all right. So we have still Kanzi, of course, and he remains, you know, very engaged with his keyboard system and the people working with him. We also have Alikia and Yodo, both of whom have been exposed to the symbols, but not nearly as consistently and as extensively as Kanzi. But all of them have, you know, exposure to the keyboard, but it's really just a matter of how engaged and how each individual scientist or individual care staff member is focusing on their work with them. And then we have Maisha, and he's really, he's also a young male, and he's also, again, been exposed to the symbols, but not worked with too extensively on their use. And then lastly, we have young Tico, and he's been a pretty significant focus of, in essence, the next generation of the symbol work. So we're trying to work with him on a fairly regular basis in terms of you know, his use of the symbols and documenting his use of the symbols and documenting his other cognitive abilities and his language abilities.
And Matata, the matriarch of this group, she also recently passed away.
That's correct. Yeah, Matata passed away several months ago. She was in her mid to upper 40s. I can't give you an exact age because she was wild caught, so it's always just an estimation with them. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, she lived a good life, but, you know, it came to an end.
With the new leadership and new direction at this project, what is the focus of the research that you're doing now?
Well, I mean, we're going to continue, and we plan to continue the work that started 30 years ago, and that is the focus on symbol acquisition and use, and what you know is necessary, and what kinds of abilities develop as a consequence of that those particular rearing experiences. Excuse me. So that part really isn't going to change. What we're really trying to do is sort of augment the research program that's there by having essentially a number of projects that spin off and capitalize on the language skills that these apes have. So, you know, one part of our focus is going to be on questions about what does acquiring a language bring, or what are the consequences of that for your other kinds of communication behaviors or cognitive functions? And I'll just give one example. We're really interested in the idea of theory of mind, so the idea that I can think, I can alter my behavior based on what I think your thoughts are. And it turns out that to try to measure something like theory of mind is very, very difficult in a nonverbal organism. But here, you know, at ACCI, I mean, we have these apes that have these communication systems, so we're able to sort of capitalize on the existence of those systems to ask something about how they think and other one of their fellow apes is thinking. So I think it's just a really unique way of asking a question about theory of mind. So that's, to some extent, the kinds of, and essentially, you know, those kinds of questions weren't really first and foremost or central to the research program. So we're trying to expand those kinds of questions. We're also really interested in aspects of genomics. We're also interested in neuropsychology as well. So we're really interested in, for example, the brain. Most people who acquire language, it's dominant in the left half of their brain. So we're really interested in, you know, how is the language system that these apes use, how is that represented in their brain? And similarly, do you get changes in gene expression, potentially gene function, and with these kinds of rearing experiences? So that's, you know, these are all just projects that are kind of building on what the skill sets are for the bonobos at our facility.
And what would actually studying brain function and doing brain scans, what would that involve for the bonobos?
Well, I mean, it could be done several ways. So there, it is a non-invasive procedure, but if you, so there's ways to do electrophysiology, so you can measure recording of electrical activity on the skull, for example. That's one way of making inferences about how the brain is working. You can also do, there's actually some temperature-based ways to measure cortical activity now that can be used pretty easily. Ideally, we would like to get a picture of each of the apes' brains. That would require that they either sit in an MRI machine voluntarily, or that we would try to collect a brain scan from them on an occasion where they would have to be under anesthesia for some other kind of procedure, for example, a survey or a full-scale physical exam or something like that. So, but that would be much more opportunistic. I think our goal
You're not proposing knocking them out to do brain scans.
No, we're not proposing to do that. We're proposing that if they are going to be knocked out, that it would be a good occasion to capture those scans if we can.
Now, one of the interesting things about this group of bonobos is the culture in which they have existed for more than 30 years. And when I spoke to Dr. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh at the facility a couple of years ago, she was very excited about the idea that Tico, the youngest bonobo, was growing up in this bilingual culture, in this bi-species culture, where he was interacting with humans as much as he was interacting with bonobos and the kind of communication that was going on there. Now, these apes had been with Sue Savage-Rumbaugh and with her sister, who was one of the primary caretakers for the bonobos, for more than three decades. They are no longer involved. How has that transition gone for the bonobos?
Well, I mean, by any measure that we have available, I mean, the bonobos are perfectly fine with, you know, the circumstances that they are now. Is that your question?
Well, have Have you been able to observe? I mean, I know that when I was visiting the facility, one of the lexicograms was for Sue, and Kanzi would call for her
right.
when he wanted to talk to her. Have you been able to observe that there is behavior that shows that he's missing the people that he spent so many years with?
We don't have any evidence of that. I mean, it's not as if you know, they appear stressed out or anything like that, or that they're using the symbol for Liz or the symbol for Sue at all, really. I mean, we haven't really seen any of that.
There have been a lot of concerns, something that we've seen a lot in the media, concerns about the health of the bonobos, a lot of conversations about Kanzi's weight, for example. And, of course, Matata was elderly when she passed away. Panbanisha was not as old, so there were concerns also about her health and her care. How is the health, the physical health of the bonobos, and what are the challenges that you see there?
I would say the physical health of the bonobos right now is excellent. Kanzi has lost some weight, and so we feel like he looks pretty good right now. I think one thing that people don't really understand about Kanzi is, you know, he is a bonobo, and bonobos are typically smaller than chimps, and typically they're kind of lanky and thin, all right? But Kanzi's father was a male named Bosanjo, and Bosanjo was a big male, and it wasn't because of anything about other than just who he was as an individual. So I think Kanzi, you know, is a bigger bonobo, but I think he comes to that size, you know, for reasons that are more than just, you know, he's not eating healthy. But I would say we've improved the diet. We've tried to limit, you know, the sweets and things like that, or the high caloric or high sugar drinks and things like that. So we've tried to improve the diet, not just for Kanzi, but for all of the apes. And then in addition to that, you know, the health and the well-being of the bonobos are really, myself and Dr. Tagliatella, I mean, this is really our first priority. And it's something that we spend a lot of time thinking about and worrying about in terms of making sure that they have adequate veterinary care and that we're monitoring their health, not reacting when they get ill, but actually trying to put in place, you know, a prevention program or a monitoring program, which I don't really think was the case before. So we're working really hard to, for example, have all of the apes work with really essentially anyone who's working with them, any of the care staff, and to have them reliably be able to present different body parts or to tolerate, you know, a rectal thermometer so we can get an accurate measure of core body temperature, and or we can use tympanic membrane we can measure the heat reflected off the tympanic membrane to collect body temperature. We're also trying to bring in a group of people called the Great Ape Heart Project. It's a group of veterinarians and veterinary technicians. One of the primary causes of death in great apes in captivity is cardiovascular disease. And about three or four years ago, this group got together and started traveling to different places and assisting zoos and research facilities in assessing, you know, cardiovascular function, particularly in the males, at different places. So we're trying to get them to come. We want to make sure that all of our apes are presenting and are able to tolerate, you know, an echocardiogram so we can get a good assessment of their heart functions. So if there's anything we need to do, we can intervene now rather than wait until their health deteriorates.
Now, a lot of the changes at the facility were precipitated by a funding crisis. When the Great Ape Trust was founded in Des Moines, it was privately funded, and that changed. And so there have been a lot of changes. What is your funding situation now?
Our funding situation is challenging. I'll be quite honest about that. Basically, we have some research dollars that we have from some existing grants that are being used to support some of the ongoing science projects right now. We've received some support from our institutions. I'm at Georgia State University. Dr. Tagliatella is at Kennesaw. They have stepped up and provided some bridge support to our organization. We do get some revenue from some of the tours and public events that we do, but primarily those are the principal sources of funding at this moment. So we have a number of grants that are out now that we're trying to get private sector support or foundation support for the institution. And we're looking, you know, for other places to generate revenue that will help us operate. But there, you know, it's a challenge and it takes some time. And so that's what we're working on very hard right now.
And do you see a future in Des Moines?
I do. I hope so. And I really hope that, you know, the citizens of Des Moines and all of Iowa, you know, get behind what we're trying to do. It's a remarkable facility. It really is. It's a state-of-the-art facility. It's. I mean, I've been doing primatology for, you know, 30 years now, and it's the best place in the world. And we have the most remarkable animals. And I think, you know, if we can just, you know, I just think we can do some really amazing things there. And I'm going to do everything I possibly can to try to keep the apes there in Des Moines and to develop our facility, not just limp along, but I mean, we really have some big plans for what we want to do going forward and what we think we can do at this facility and in Des Moines.
And you're actually hoping to bring more apes into the facility in the future?
To some extent. So the NIH has made the decision to essentially retire some of the chimpanzees that are currently residing in different facilities around the U.S. So the NIH owns about 450 of them. And so we're very interested in bringing some of those apes to our facility. We have a lot of space. We actually have a vacant building now that could house probably 20 chimpanzees, maybe more. And, you know, we really see that as a great potential resource, not just, you know, in terms of providing revenue for our facility, but also broadening the research program in really significant ways. We would have then at our facility, both bonobos and chimpanzees, which we heard great stories from, right, from Jill just a moment ago, in the same facility. And you know, having these two species in the same place where we can do these really, really nice comparative studies looking at how they differ and how they're similar and how that maps onto different...
It could be very exciting. Bill, we're out of time, but thank you so much for talking with me today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bill Hopkins is the president and staff scientist at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.